now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now Intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
All right, Dean Haglund, stop laughing, stop complaining, stop bugging me. Get to your report all about Iron Fest.
What, just like that?
Well, okay, I'm Phil Lairness. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. Down under, here's Dean Haglund talking about Iron Fest. What is it?
Do you
what
even
were you doing
know
there?
What Iron Fest is?
No, I really don't. Idea. I know it has something to do with analyzing the way that metal plays a role in our lives.
Well, you think that's a joke.
No, no, I do not think that's a joke. I think that that's what metal, what Iron Fest is in part. Yeah.
Well, in part. Okay, so I'm not even, it's been running for 18 years now in the Blue Mountains in a lovely town called Lithgow in New South Wales, Australia. And the weekend, as it was told to me, is, you know, it's a bit of everything. And you're like, well, what does that mean? And in fact, that is an accurate way to describe it. It is a fair on the showgrounds that has, amongst other things, there was a Civil War.
Okay, wait a second. Is it, you said it's a fair on the showgrounds, or is it a show on the fairgrounds?
No, they call it the showgrounds, and it has a fair, like a, you know, county fair type atmosphere.
See, that's so strange, so, because here we do put on events and we call them shows, and where are they set? At the fairgrounds. But it's down right. Under, so those words go counterclockwise,
opposite,
I guess.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
All
just
right.
Like the water down the toilet.
And so it's 18 years of these shows, and I wasn't joking. I mean, I only vaguely have a knowledge of it, but yes, it's been around for a while, and it's multimedia, isn't it? Arts, multi-disciplines,
analyzing.
It's a festival of the humanities, is what I would imagine. Really,
that's a way better. You know, if that's about the best way to describe it, because it's got everything. Your favorite genre, steampunk, is well represented there. As many people dressed in their steampunked attire. There's also a Renaissance, Ren Fair type people. And then there's subgenres like the Filthy Dirty Peasants from Monty Python's Holy Grail. They had a whole little village set up, as did a post-apocalypse little area that had sort of a whole living environment. And they were all dressed in their sort of Mad Max Beyond the Thunderdome attire. So all of these things are all situated so kind of right next to each other. So, for instance, the vintage car show, which was about 15 cars parked on the grass, was right next to the very informative snake handler who was showing off dangerous and deadly black snakes, tiger snakes that he had in bags, and he was holding them up, explaining how not to get killed by them and what to do and which ones are aggressive and which ones aren't aggressive.
Okay, so let's start right there. What does that have to do, though, with metal?
Well, nothing. See, I think we use the term Iron Fest as the common element that combines us all. It could have been called Carbon Fest, as in we're all carbon-based life forms. That as well would have been just as apropos. So it had everything that you can imagine. And of course, you know, there's a whole new renaissance in blacksmithing. So artisan blacksmiths, about 8, 10 stations.
Okay, I get that. I get that. Now you're back to metals, because here's the actual description, okay? Iron Fest celebrates the relationship between humanity and iron, steel, and other metals. So I can see how many of the things you described cut in. The bag of snakes, I'm unclear on.
Well, as is the guy who was hand-carving wooden swords and shields in the Viking area. Technically, none of those were metal. That was all wood.
But what was he using to carve them?
Okay, there you go. Well done. Well played, Mr. Lerness. That's exactly right. He did have a sharp object for the wood.
So is this the first time you've been to this?
Yes. Yes, and it was highly entertaining. I was hosting the evening ball, of course, where...
And of course, about, of course. Together. What else would of you course. Be doing?
What else would I be doing?
Because your knee, because your knee is made of titanium, one of the metals that...
Yeah, so I was invited to say, that you're celebrating metal, and yes, in your own body, why not come to Iron Fest? It makes so much sense.
This was your first time attending.
Yes.
And you were invited to host a ball. I hope you were invited.
But also,
you were invited or not invited?
No, I was invited. Yes, no, I was advertised as being there. That's correct.
All right. And were they disappointed that you didn't have your old heavy metal hair? Okay.
Oh, my heavy metal hair. That's what it was called. Oh, that's way better than all the times somebody said mullet.
So you hosted the ball. What does that mean to host the ball? I mean, like, are you announcing, my lords and ladies, the Duke of Umbridge?
Yes, but it wasn't just my lord. No, because, wait, hold. Step one back. The theme this year wasn't Renaissance. It was Wild Wild West. So, in fact, many people were dressed in their cowboy best, hats and bolo ties, the whole nine yards.
Was Wild Wild West not the first? It may not have been, but it's the first that I can think of from my childhood television show that embraced the steampunk aesthetics, by the way. Wild Wild West.
Yes, that's correct. But it wasn't the theme wasn't Wild Wild West, just Wild West.
Oh, okay.
So you removed one wild, so you could have the steampunk. But it was also actual, just authentic cowboy gear.
All right.
Does that help at all?
And so you were asked to do this because of our podcast's top 10 all-time Westerns?
I did not put the connection together, but in fact, I was asked to do this. The woman who I've met many a times at many of the conventions, the Supernova Cons and the Oz Comic Cons and all of that sort of thing, runs a store called Demon Kitty. You can see it at demonkitty.com.au, I think it is. And she was producing it this year. So she asked me to come and host and MC the ball so that it would move right along. What with the mayor coming up, who has a gift of the gab apparently, and then the burlesque dancers after that, so I was the master of ceremonies at the old ball. So that was my whole function there.
It's interesting. I've been having some discussion about the role of masters of ceremonies recently, apropos of the Breakfast Club. Yeah, and it is interesting that, you know, I don't know if you'll agree with this, but the first and last job of a master of ceremonies is to keep things moving, right? To keep things moving along. And it is so funny how often the master of ceremonies is the reason why things aren't moving along.
Well, true, because, you know, we all have a perspective from our own angles, so we assume that we're the most important thing.
Oh, that's
in the
a good
show.
Point. That's a good point. Yeah,
right?
Yeah. But it's true,
seen
right?
It many times, the stand-up. Yep.
If a master of ceremonies just does that, they're good. If they can do that and turn when things go wrong into gold, well, then they're excellent, right? But
exactly.
Well, so this was fun for you, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, amazingly fun.
And
the most fun con I've been to in a long time. Actually.
And did you spend the whole weekend there, or did you just go for your event and hang out a little bit beforehand? Or I mean,
we went.
Was this
Saturday.
A sleepaway camp or not?
It was a sleepaway. Yes, we overnighted it so that we didn't do the 2-hour commute at midnight through the curvy roads through the Blue Mountains. That way, we had all the time in the world the next day to hang out at the fair and see more reenactments. There was the World War II reenactment of the Sahara Desert battle done on wood chips. There was no sand. So it was not historically super accurate, but it was fascinating nonetheless.
It's really sounding less and less like a festival exploring the relationship between humanity and metals, and much more like the season premiere of HBO's Westworld, which comes actually tonight here in the States. So,
funny you should say that. Yeah, there was a Westworld contingent. Yeah. No, that's also accurate, I guess.
Now, what about conventions? Do you have any? Because this came out of the blue, man. I did not even know about this. So. Maybe we should mention if you have any others upcoming anywhere in the world.
Well, there's an exciting one that's coming up this November. That's an all X-Files convention in Meadowlands, New Jersey, that includes myself and David Duchovny coming to a rare convention appearance, and he's bringing his band. Of all things, so I think that November 17th and 18th, for everybody in the sound of my voice, you want to book your flight to New York City, and take the what's the tunnel, the Jersey Tunnel over to Meadowlands to come to this massive convention. It's an X-Files only convention, and I'm not sure who's all attending. Not all the contracts have been signed yet, but it looks like it'll be almost the complete cast.
Well, I know we're planning on doing a little bit of a Rust Belt tour of the Lady Killers in fall, but maybe we ought to try to set up the New York screening for then, since you're going to be back there. Wouldn't that be fun? Anyway.
That would be fun.
So we'll keep people apprised of that.
Yes.
Excellent.
That'll be fun.
Now, had Patty known about Iron Fest in advance, would we still be moving to Detroit?
Well, actually, she so enjoyed it. She said, I hope Detroit has some sort of steampunk convention, because she enjoyed the whole aesthetic of it. And sure enough, Motor City Steam is a thing that goes on in July. So perhaps we may attempt to attend that as well.
I feel like you could just go to burnt out buildings there and find what you would mistake for a steampunk convention at any time. Much like I mistook their international airport for a Logan's Run convention, but that's a different story altogether.
Altogether.
Hey, you know, apropos really of nothing, except I guess I mentioned maybe the Breakfast Club or whatever, but our friend in podcasting, Mark Hershon, was in LA this week, and for the first time came to the LA Breakfast Club. And
really?
You know, of course, he's the announcer, not the original, but he's the I think he took over probably episode 4 or 5 as the announcer of Los Angeles Breakfast Club on the Air, the other podcast that I do, the monthly review of happenings and history and the colorful characters that make up the one and only democracy of ham and eggs. And this was the first time he'd ever attended. And it was great because it coincided with me taking the stage a few minutes before our 7:30 start time to record some live pieces for the podcast. It's been decided that it would be a good thing for me to do, not every week, but semi-regularly, to record brief little live pieces that can be included in the podcast so that there's not quite such the, I don't know, the hard and fast delineation between clips from the podcast and my studio pieces. You know, that if we can bridge them in a more organic way. And so it was great because I went up to start recording it and I said, I thought we would start with some announcements. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this voice comes, "Good idea, Phil." And of course, it's Mark Hirshon. I go, "Mark, is that you?" "Yes, it's me, your announcer, Mark Hirshon." And so from hidden behind the curtains, he recorded a whole bunch of live announcements and they were hilarious. I almost feel That's like they're so, nice. So hilarious that they belong on this show rather than on the Breakfast Club podcast. But anyway, but I'm sure I'll be able to figure out how to use some of them. But that was good fun.
There you go. Yeah. I'm glad that now the Breakfast Club, I'm surprised because I sent my friend there. You said now is requires reservations.
Oh, this has been quite a while. This has been for quite a while now. Yes. Reservations
blown
only.
Away.
Yeah. In fact, once a month or so, in fact, it's so popular that it requires advance tickets on Eventbrite.
Holy smokes.
Yes.
That's insane.
It is insane. Well, yeah.
Congratulations then to you and Lily for reviving what organization on its... Clearly, its last legs.
We reached a tipping point. I forget at which point Lily said, we both had read the Malcolm Gladwell book, The Tipping Point, and she really took it to heart, really studied it. You know, I mean, seriously went out and found her Maven and her connector. And I remember, it was maybe just about a year ago where she said, "I think we've just reached the tipping point." And you're right. I mean, it was only a few years ago where, Lily went or even when I started, where weeks of poor turnouts, there might be as few as 20 people there. And a really, really big turnout might be 40. Now our minimum is 50. And we're regularly in the 70s and 80s. And that's just within a couple years. So I would imagine that a year from now, we're talking about the minimum being 70 and, you know, regularly in the hundreds. Yeah, I mean, so it's such a change that, we're at 70, I think, active members right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we're already talking about what number do we cap membership at, something that was never done in the past, of course, where they often had 500 members. But one of the things, again, that Lily has studied is that when groups and organizations and even corporations get past 150, seems to be the magic number, when they get past 150, they become very easy to topple and are often top heavy. And often what happens is exactly what happened to the Breakfast Club. It goes quickly and things aren't being preserved and archived because everyone looks around the room and looks and says, "Wow, there's 500 people. Of course, someone else is going to take care of this."
Right.
But when you keep the group a little bit smaller, people take more onto themselves to make sure that things keep running smoothly and keep being preserved for future people. And so so she studied this a lot, and she studied the history of corporations that wisely, when they get past 150, branch out, create a new branch in totally different digs so that that one continues to be, that division continues to be 150.
Right.
Or that branch of that division or whatever. And so it's fascinating stuff that she really, really threw herself into. And so it's pretty cool. But there's always room, of course, for Dean Haglund.
Ah, well, that's so kind.
We have a Chicago chapter, so, you may very well have to be the de facto chair of the Detroit chapter.
Well, oh, right.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't involve anything other than just having breakfast at the at the club when you're in LA.
Yeah. Yeah, no, no. It sounded like it was going to be really hard work.
All right. That's quite a few different sort of live events that we've talked about. And if anybody is coming to LA and interested in the Breakfast Club, why not mention it? They can learn more at labreakfastclub.com or on Facebook, facebook.com/LA Breakfast Club. Different presentations each week. And that's enough about that. But do check it out, because if you're going to be in LA, it is... unlike anything else. I was going to say it's a lot of fun. It's unlike anything else. I think that's safe to say.
It's almost like Iron Fest.
And in its own way. Yeah, I don't know how you describe it. I know, again, this would be a pejorative to you, but you've got to appreciate the insight and the cleverness of the person who came up with it. A journalist describing the Breakfast Club said that it, and he said this at the time before the Garrison Keillor sexual harassment allegations. So back then you were allowed to still say Prairie Home Companion and not Town Hall or whatever the name of the show is now. But he described the Breakfast Club as a Prairie Home Companion as directed by David Lynch. So I salute that description. It's as good as any I've ever heard. Why, look who's here coming at us live from Miami. It's Lily Holloman. Lily, Dean Haglund and I were just talking about you.
Bienvenido.
No, we were talking about you.
Oh, okay. I thought it was Venito. Okay.
No, we were talking about the fabulous work you've done with the Breakfast Club, restoring it. Dean's quite impressed. Now, dear listeners... there may come a time later in the show, because we've been recording some things out of order, where we make reference to Lily Holloman being upcoming on today's show. If that makes it through the extensive editorial session we perform on this show, I apologize. This is Lily Holloman now. She's no longer upcoming. She's here now in the present. Lily, how are things in Miami?
Miami is a balmy humidity. My hair has grown exponentially since coming here. And it's really a good time. I've never spent any time beyond a few hours before a cheesy spring break college cruise in this town. And I'm charmed.
Well, that's fantastic. What are you doing there? I trust it's a spring break college cruise, then.
Well, I am at Outshine Miami Film Festival, which is an LGBTQ festival. And I am here with the movie Funny Story, which is a film that I shot last summer that I play a mind-reading, chakra-cleansing gal named Moon River. And we just premiered the movie tonight. It stars Matthew Glaive and Emily Bette Ricard from the Arrow TV series.
Okay, I'm gonna just cut you off there. I hope people can understand what you're saying. I know about this movie, and I can barely make it out. I mean, your phone is the equivalent of two paper cups and a 3,000-mile-foot string. But what we lack in being able to understand, we more than make up for in a really lovely tinny hollow sound. So you're in this movie, it's Funny Story. You play a chakra something psychic,
chakra cleansing mind reading psychic,
So they just turned on the camera and pointed and said, just make stuff up, Lily Holloman.
It's basically I'm playing myself.
Yes.
Let's be honest.
So this movie premiered at Slam Dance to great acclaim.
Yes, it did.
And has played a handful of other festivals, including, I think, San Luis Obispo, if I'm not mistaken.
Indeed.
And getting good reviews. Your work is getting praised. But they flew you to Miami for this festival. And when I say they, I mean the festival themselves. And we'll talk about that for just a second in a moment. But this was the first chance you actually had to see the film. So were you happy?
I was thrilled. And I was thrilled to really understand some of the themes of the film that kind of eluded me when I read the script. It seeing it come to life was so gratifying, and to watch the theme of how no matter how far we run from where we come from our parents, from the dysfunction in those relationships, whether we are gay or straight, we will run headlong inevitably into marrying our father or mother. It does not matter your sexual preference. And this is such a refreshing take on that, because it is about a same-sex marriage and the mirror image between this dysfunctional father and this dysfunctional fiancé that the main character of Nick, played by Jana Winternitz, is about to marry. And I've never seen anything like that on screen, and I really enjoyed it. And I'm so proud of the movie and the work they did.
Great, great. We'll keep people informed of how they can see this movie. But you were brought down not only because you were in the movie, but as I understand it, also because you are a female producer.
I have been talking about being a female producer. Of course, as you know, Phil, we produced a movie together.
What?
It's called The Lady Killers, and I did talk about that in the Q&A, and we've been doing a lot of workshops about crowdfunding and pitch meetings, and I've learned so much from my peers.
So there's been a focus on women in film and women filmmakers at this event?
There was a focus. They are, as a part of this festival, they have been very male-heavy in terms of the LGBTQ representation. It's been heavy with gay men, and so they wanted to bring in more women, more films about the lesbian experience. And though I don't necessarily identify with that, I am proud to be an ally of that kind of storytelling, and I think it's important that we integrate these stories into the mainstream, and I think that's happening more and more.
Okay. I had one other question for you. I don't remember really what it was now, and we're running woefully short on time, so I'll just close with this. How has your hair been, other than growing exponentially in the humidity, how has your new hairdo performed in Miami?
I think it's a big hit in Miami proper, and it goes well with the bright colors that are ever present in the area. So I'm glad about that. I'm not sure it'll be a long-term experience, but it is a bright blonde that fits in nicely.
Excellent. All right, Lily Holloman, congratulations on the big screening and on all the work you do on behalf of the lesbian community.
And congratulations on this interview, Phil.
Bienvenido. Hey, Dean, how about a couple of celebrity deaths?
Let's see him.
I thought you were going to say, don't mind if I do.
Celebrity deaths.
Oh, that's terrible.
So I don't want to be guilty of perpetuating a stereotype, especially if it does not hold in the realm of reality. So I will pose it as a question. But it strikes me that we often hear stories like the one that we will be discussing where Vern Troyer is concerned. And it's about celebrity people of a certain diminutive stature committing suicide. And am I wrong in, I mean, it just feels to me that that's a conversation we've had in the past.
Yeah.
And that it is almost a trope in show business of the famous little person who ends up taking their own life.
Well, now, give me a hand. Who else are you, fits into that category? I'm not actually going through my
history. Was Hervé Villechaize not a...
Oh, yes. But was he... Oh, my gosh.
What?
I thought that was just a medical condition he had.
Well, let's talk about...
What's happening?
Let's talk about Vern Troyer for a minute.
yeah, okay.
Because you cut out a little bit, so I don't know what your reaction was to that. But he's best known, of course, for playing Mini-Me in the Austin Powers movies. He died at age 49 just this weekend. And, you know, the death, the cause of death has not been mentioned, but the official statement announcing his death on his Facebook page does say, quote, depression and suicide are very serious issues. You never know what kind of battle someone is going through inside. Be kind to one another and always know it's never too late to reach out to someone for help.
Right.
So I think it's... it would be unlikely that they would write that if indeed they weren't aware that suicide was responsible for Vern Troyer's death.
Right.
So you don't know whether or not this is a trope, as we say, the little person.
I don't know, because I also know. Let's see. I'm going through the history of Hollywood back into the silent era. And boy, I am stuck to figure out another suicide, a similar circumstance as Vern Troyer. So,
well,
I'm going to say
it is interesting. I'm finding a lot of articles about how beyond show business. Suicide and depression is a very significant issue within the little person community for midgets and people with dwarfism. Often because, I guess, 80% of such people are the only members of their family who experience those conditions. And so it exacerbates the isolation that so many people feel anyway. And but I just I guess we'll have to save it for another day then. I thought for sure you were going to say, oh, yeah, that's a thing.
Yeah,
that's a thing.
I know. Right. I think you were setting me up for that. And I go, I'm not 100% sure that is a thing, but I now have to research, which I was told there'd be no research with this show. But OK,
for you,
I'm going to get on that. Yeah, for me.
I mean, you couldn't even bother to find out what the hell the festival was that you were at. So
I can describe it, but yeah, no, well.
But I feel like Rappaport, right? The actor who was in
Michael Rappaport.
No, David Rappaport, not Michael Rappaport, the 6'5" basketball-playing actor. No, we're talking about little people. No. The actor from Time Bandits, right? I thought...
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
He was... I mean, we're just getting into so much trouble if these things are wrong. So we will... I'll do my research and find out, and we will celebrate all the little person suicides that have... this is horrible. This is horrible. This is
horrible.
Quite honestly our worst show ever. So maybe we should just move along. And
and you're breaking up on me too. So it's just it's I'm getting 75% of the worst show ever.
Well, I'm glad then that I'm breaking up on you, because I didn't want it to just be... I mean, the good news is when I'm breaking up on you, I'm being recorded in perfect fashion. And when you're breaking up on me, no one's hearing you. So that's the good news.
My voice falls into the Pacific.
If you want to hear me, you can just play back the show. If I want to hear you... I'm out of luck. I'm shit out of luck. All right. Remembering a Grammy-winning country music artist and producer, and this is one that I don't just do out of some obligation to get the bodies out of the morgue, but because I'm actually a fan. Randy Scruggs died at 64, had a brief illness. He is the son of bluegrass legend Earl Scruggs. Big fan of Earl Scruggs. Right. But Randy Scruggs, his music was often instrumental and fantastic and just a terrific go-to, you know, studio musician on other people's albums as well. He's a guitarist, fantastic guitarist. I mean, played on tracks for Johnny Cash, for Dolly Parton, all like the Rushmore of country music, Randy Travis, Vince Gill. But also a producer. I mean, he produced for Waylon Jennings and recently for Alison Krauss, who's terrific. So Randy Scruggs, the real deal, one of those people that reminds you that great musicians, no matter their genre, would have been successful, I think, in any genre.
Wow.
I think it's possible, right, to become successful within a genre if you really understand it and can get that particular unique sort of hook, right? But great musicians in any genre really transcend. And I think no matter... You know, I always felt that way about when disco died, right? I felt like it was a little bit unfair, for example, that Donna Summer's career hit the skids for so long, because if there had never been disco, Donna Summer still would have been a great, great popular singer because she had the pipes. But because the sound of disco could be so easily imitated, there was this tendency for quite a few years to just toss aside anyone who could be painted with the disco brush.
Right. Yeah, and then that sort of shifted the whole genre down to a mocking lame-o sides. Yeah, as I remember it as a kid.
And I think people who reject country music, there's a tendency to do the same thing, right? To think that it all sounds so similar and to not realize, you know, the virtuoso musicianship on the part of a lot of these practitioners. So Randy Scruggs, one of the greats, dead at 64. Dean, two very odd movies that, I mean, odd in yeah, both uniquely odd and in wanting to discuss them in conjunction with each other, even more odd. I have no segue at all to begin with this, except that I am a Robert Aldrich fan, as you know, the director of Dirty Dozen, the director of Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, Kiss Me Deadly, The Longest Yard, the prison football movie. Big fan of his, and I often enjoy catching his movies that I've never seen or maybe saw when I was young. The year after The Longest Yard was such a big hit, he reteamed with Burt Reynolds for just about the most unusual cop movie I've ever seen. And
Sharky's Machine.
No, but Sharky's Machine was directed by Burt Reynolds, who wanted John Borman to direct. And John Borman was exhausted after Excalibur and said, Burt, you could direct this yourself. And no less than Janet Maslin in the New York Times talked about what a great director Burt Reynolds was. Sharky's Machine, I don't know if people realize this, a really good movie. And still, the tallest free fall stunt in the history of movies, filmed there at Peachtree Plaza in Atlanta, which we know very, very well.
Very well. Look at you. But you're all up on the history of Sharky's Machine. That's fantastic.
And Sharky's Machine, of course, a modern day adaptation of Burt Reynolds' favorite film noir, Laura, which did not make either of our lists as one of the top 10 best mysteries. All right. But this is 6 years before. The year after Longest Yard, so 1975, Burt Reynolds stars in movie called Hustle with Robert Aldrich. And his movies are always, Robert Aldrich's movies, let's face it, are always odd because they'll go to such dark places and they'll go there gleefully at the drop of a hat.
Right.
And because of that dark, really nasty, almost sadistic, no, I would say outright sadistic sense of humor that is in all of Aldrich's Touchstone films, the movies lend themselves to the bizarre. And this one, with Burt Reynolds as a police lieutenant in Los Angeles, Paul Winfield, fresh off an Oscar nomination for Sounder, plays his partner. Catherine Deneuve plays Burt Reynolds' girlfriend, a high-class call girl. Very important to make it clear that she's high class, because that means disease free. Right. And he's in love with her, but they have trouble because he's a cop and she's a whore. And and the thing is, it's such an unusual movie because you never actually know what the movie is about. And only at the end of the movie do you realize, wait, this was a love story masquerading as a cop movie. So it's a couple of days in the life of this cop, and we get to explore a couple of his cases. We get to see what happens in a couple of these cases. But it's also about just what the randomness of violence and what these people see do to them and do to their relationships. It is an utterly politically inappropriate movie. I think it might have been at that time. Though, whether it's exploiting albinos or standing up for the rights of albinos, I'm not quite sure, but the fact that albinos are even entering into the mix lets you know what an unusual movie this is. And you know, when Burt Reynolds got an Oscar nomination for Boogie Nights, so many people reacted by saying, oh my God, Burt Reynolds is really good. And I always said, Burt Reynolds was always good. That was never an issue. He was always good. It's just he would do anything for a buck, and the movies were often terrible. But he was the real deal. He was, at worst, a solid workmanlike craftsman. At worst.
Right.
And him with Catherine Deneuve, this movie... If Robert Aldrich of The Dirty Dozen and The Longest Yard made a French New Wave anti-romantic love story, this is what it would be.
Now, I'm seeming now remembering this. Is this Burt Reynolds at the end walks into, like, in the middle of a robbery? And
okay,
then just gets
No, you did. the spoiler of all. Is this the movie at the end where he dies? Oh, my God.
Well, you said that already.
No, I did not. I talked about how the violence affects them, not that he dies. Wow. That's...
Well, now you have to see it.
No, now nobody will ever see it. But yes, you are right. That is the movie, and I love that you've seen this. How did you see this?
I can't remember.
Why did you see this? It is... It is a movie that is riveting, sometimes because of how much it doesn't work. And then it'll drop into something that is just so unusual. I mean, a cop movie where our tough butch main character takes time out to go to a Westwood theater to watch the French classic A Man and a Woman. And we're in the theater with him for quite a few minutes watching this movie.
Are we really? Yeah. Oh, my God. So, okay, clearly I've never seen the whole thing. I just now, going through my Burt Reynolds repertoire in my head, realize I've only seen the end of this, which is probably why it didn't make any sense to me. Because it was like, you know, I'm reminded of that Broadway play that I can't remember either, that I just was famous that the lead actor on stage a shot rings out from a random sniper that hadn't appeared anywhere else in a play, no mention of him, but a shot rings out and then the lead actor dies on stage and then the curtains close. This was a very,
because it's the movie that's kind of least about, it's the least cop movie because again, the story isn't really about that. It's a love story. That's the narrative arc. And yet, it's probably the most about police of most movies involving police that I've ever seen because, as I always say in like my acting classes, when you're playing a cop, you got to remember that for most cops, that's a job like any other. It's the job that they do day after day after day. And yes, there's some real danger involved, but there's danger involved in other, occupations as well. But, but you know, you don't play it as a cop, you play it as a person and that's the job that they do. And, and so this really, is fascinating in that I gotta say, it's almost like 10 years, it's like a precursor to Hill Street Blues.
Wow.
And just so odd coming from this group. But the thing that I really wanted to point out and what kind of blew my mind to realize this, it's a hit. It's not a hit like Longest Yard. And of course, it's in part a hit because they kept the budget at a reasonable, imagine that, with big stars, they kept the budget at a reasonable size. And a year after this huge hit, The Longest Yard, the reteaming of Burt Reynolds and Robert Aldrich, there's an appetite for that. But also Catherine Deneuve was quite a popular international performer. But what I love is you could have a movie be a love story where the character happens to be a cop. And you would never have anything like that now. Right?
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, maybe in a quote-unquote romantic comedy, one of the love interests will be a cop. But that's just so that we can have the excuse of some third act action in
right.
there.
I'm thinking of Poseidon Adventure, where Ernest Borgnine's the cop and co-actress is the... they're now a married couple that their backstory was she was an often arrested prostitute. That's how they started their relationship. If you remember all the character arcs from Poseidon Adventure.
So I think that's fascinating and just shows what, again.
Where did you just see this recently?
I had recorded it a while ago. There's a great HD network. There's two. I don't know which one this was off of, but there's one called HD Net Movies and another one called Retroplex. And HD masters of lesser-known films from days gone by. And it's really quite rewarding for me. But it was very refreshing and just another reminder of how fascinating the 1970s were for American cinema, all the different influences that were being expressed and explored, and indeed, filmmaking really just as it did by the end of the 1920s, by the 1970s pre Star Wars, filmmaking had reached its apex, and
right.
And then of course Star Wars changes everything, and in an effort to go after that money, then a whole lot of really sloppy filmmaking and filmmaking paradigms get instituted, and maybe we're only now starting to figure that out. Though I don't know. I think we're still experiencing the trouble. We're not approaching another apex. And that brings me to the other movie that I saw, and it's an adaptation of one of my favorite books that I've ever talked about on this show, The Lost City of Z, or The Lost City of Zed, as it was known originally, based on the book by David Gran. A great book. David Gran, a journalist who documents his own research into the long lost and almost forgotten explorer Fawcett, who first mapped Amazonia for the the Royal Geographic Society in England, and who was a decorated World War I soldier, and how Fawcett may have died not realizing that he had in fact discovered this city, the remains of the city he was looking for, but a city that easily supported more than a million people along the Amazon banks, the city that those conquistadors wrote about, that everyone subsequent to them wrote off as fever dreams or hallucinations. But no, it turns out the Amazon basin was home to megalopolises predating any such European settlements. And the adaptation of it, interestingly enough, begins many years before the book comes out. It begins while the book is in galley forms. Brad Pitt gets a hold of it, and he options it and gives it to writer-director James Gray to adapt. And James Gray adapts it into what he describes as a Lawrence of Arabia on hallucinogens epic that focuses entirely on Fawcett and not at all on the later day efforts to track him down or the efforts on the part of the journalist to ascertain the truth behind the story, which are equal parts of the book.
Right. Like Dr. Livingston.
Yeah. I didn't see it when it came out, despite the fact that it got pretty good reviews, and despite the fact that it did underwhelming box office, which usually makes me want to support something. But
right.
But and it made no small number of top 10 lists. I mean, it was in the overall consensus top 20 for the year last year, and yet I had a hard time bringing myself to it because I love that book so much. And
right.
the experience is that it's so different from the book that I was relieved. It could stand on its own. At the same time,
really?
It didn't stand on its own. It relied on just how compelling the actual story is. But I spent equal amounts of time either wishing I was reading the book or wishing that I was watching Lawrence of Arabia. Because, boy, nobody knows how to make an epic of exploration anymore, I guess. And part of the problem is it's a $30 million budget, which is a lot of money, but not enough to do this story if you're going to do it well. And I think Lawrence sets the template you want to follow, which is
right.
You want to spare no expense on location filming, creating authenticity, scope, and peopling it with a combination of beloved international character actors and a lead that we feel we are discovering for the first time. That's the template.
Right.
Charlie Hunnam, as this explorer Fawcett, gives an entirely one-note performance, as does Sienna Miller, who plays his wife. And it's a good note. It's a good note that they've mastered.
Good note.
That they play again and again and again. But it's reminiscent of some of the complaints I have about some of James Franco's work, not all, but where he'll play the scenes very well, but there's no connective tissue that lets you know that that scene is affecting the character and changing the character so that then they come to the next scene slightly different than the earlier ones.
Right.
This is a movie that follows a man through decades of his life, and his personality stays the same. His method of verbal delivery stays utterly the same. The way he plays every single scene stays the same. His energy stays the same. And what a disappointment.
That is a disappointment.
Because, again, the unique nature of the world of the 19-teens and 1920s, when there was still so much of this world left to be discovered, and how the exploration of those things revealed the unique makeup of human beings at that time offers no shortage of food for drama and comedy and romance. And it's every scene is well done, and they do as little with all that potential food as possible.
Wow. Now, Brad Pitt, just executive producing this. No other creative input from him?
Well, I mean, I think he's the leading creative input. I mean, it's Plan B. It's there. Right. It's his company. So,
right. But now I know why I didn't see this. Because what was the name of that zombie movie he did?
World War Z.
World War Z. So I thought this was a sequel of that zombie movie.
Wouldn't that be great?
I didn't realize.
The Lost City of World War Z. Yeah, that would be fantastic. How nobody has done that mashup, I don't know. And Lost City of Z also stars Robert Pattinson, who is famously undead anyway, right? Because of all the Twilight movies. So.
Totally. So I can't believe, well, that rang in my head because it was, you know, off my radar. So that was the lazy connected dot that I'm sure I'm not the only one who did that. In fact, so I imagine that's why it also slugged at the box office a little bit.
But it just, Lawrence of Arabia has everything going for it. And I know comparing films to that are unfair to a degree. But at the same time, that's the template. And if you're not aiming for it, if you're not learning from it, well, then what the hell are you doing? That film had everything you could possibly want, and that this film didn't give me anything that I want.
Right.
The cinematography is beautiful, and again, the story is innately interesting, but they do as little with it as possible. And I can't believe there are no executives anywhere that couldn't have said, you know, yeah, when are we going to do our Lawrence of Arabia? Here's a big amount of money, and let's make a global epic that is incredibly successful, and we can follow the template to do it. It just seems so odd, because even $30 million is too much to spend on a movie like this, where your biggest name is Robert Pattinson, and yet he admirably, as he seems very interested in doing, is kind of disappearing into a supporting character role. You know, there's a kid who has parlayed his Twilight success in a very interesting way, you know, and I've talked about that before, but I don't think he's necessarily a great actor, but he wants to be.
Right. And he's just waiting for the right role to come along?
Well, no, I think he's learning. I mean, I think sometimes he's cast adrift. That movie he did with the Safdie brothers, Good Time, that I talked about this last year, showed some of his best work. But he's taking the roles. He's interested in exploring characters. And he's taking the roles that are giving him the chance to do it, and not at any point, much like Kristen Stewart is now doing, you know, after the hell of doing that Snow White movie, both these young people are really, instead of cashing in on their fame from Twilight, they really have been
seeking to out go beyond that,
where the interesting work is. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. And making epics, back to that. I mean, the one movie that comes to mind is, in today's aesthetic and today's executives, I think Matt Damon in The Great Wall would be somebody trying to embrace the idea of epic for today's moviegoers in today's sensibilities. International cast, lots of action, monsters, you know, the whole thing.
Well, you know, a movie that follows the template, of course, of Lawrence of Arabia was Raiders of the Lost Ark 20 years later. Follows the template.
Right.
You know what doesn't follow the template? The later Raiders movies. All the other Indiana Jones movies. Same director, same character, same genre, not following the template at all. It is maybe the type of movie that I know I'll never get the opportunity to do, but that I wonder sometimes if actually I might, you know, this is one of those I was born in the wrong time, because I think I might have been equipped to be able to pull off a movie like that.
The what ifs and the could have beens.
All right. The new name for the show. Once you move to Detroit, the what ifs and the could have beens. And you can find all the what ifs and the could have beens that we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com, chillpackhollywood.com. You can like us on Facebook.
Please like us.
Facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Chillpackhollywood.
Yes. Can people write us, Dean Haglund?
Oh my gosh, can they? Right, it's at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We all spell out the word A. And
what?
We give great hashtag.
Hashtag we give great hashtag.
Right. Well, you would know to add the hashtag.
Yes, I would. Spoiler alert, he dies at the end. Okay.
Oh my God. That's so obvious. Everybody. That was on the movie poster. That's exactly how they spelled that thing.
You know, I think next week wraps out 11 years of your
good Lord
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. So I think next week might be an anniversary show, unless my instant math is wrong. But if it is, boy, do we have a special show planned for you one way or another. It won't suck. I promise. I'm Phil Lernis. I'll talk to you next week.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.